If you've been with us more recently, then you'll know that we won't surprise you at all where we're going in the Bible this morning. We're going to the Gospel of Matthew. We've been in the Gospel of Matthew now for over 2 years. And we're going to endeavor to the end of it. Originally, I was hoping that we'd be able to make it to the resurrection passages by the time Easter got here. But Easter's coming early this year, so whether we would do that or not, I'm not sure. But I want to talk with you about something this morning. And when we read this passage, you can say, we've already heard that twice. And so when we come to things like this, I really try to bring things into picture that were not necessarily brought in before when we study particular passages like this. Number one is this, is we need to understand something. When Jesus says something a number of times, that means it's really, really important, right? Like, truly, truly, I say to you. So we need to understand that this message, particular message that Jesus speaks this morning to his disciples and to you and I, is a message of very great importance. Have you ever heard anyone talk about the humiliation of Christ? Theologians think about it sometimes. Theologians talk about it sometimes. But imagine it is a topic probably that has lost a lot of emphasis in the modern-day church, and there are probably a lot of places you could go every Sunday for your whole lifetime, and you would never one time hear anyone talk about the humiliation of our Lord Jesus Christ. Our Westminster Confession helps us understand what we're talking about here, so let me just read this for you. It's question number 27 in the Shorter Catechism. Wherein did Christ's humiliation consist? And the answer is this. Christ's humiliation consisted in his being born, and that in a low condition, made under the law, undergoing the miseries of this life, the wrath of God, and the cursed death of the cross, and being buried and continuing under the power of death for a time. Matthew chapter 20, verses 17 through 19. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and on the way he said to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him, and on the third day he will be raised up." Again, this is not the first time that he has said this to these 12 guys. And we know that Jesus does not repeat himself just for the heck of it, that he always has purpose in it. And I would imagine that one of the reasons we see this again here is this, is we need to understand that the ministry of Jesus at this point has really changed a lot ever since Matthew 16. Not so much out in public, not so much with the crowds, not so much healing emphasis and things like that. What we find more and more is his focus on these 12 guys to teach them, to prepare them, because Jerusalem is growing ever closer. And this is a thing that is more in the mind of Jesus at this point in his ministry, I would imagine, than just about everything else. And that is that Jerusalem's coming, and his trial is coming, and his scourging is coming, and his torture is coming, and his humiliation is coming, and his death on the cross is coming, and he knows it. And we know from the Garden of Gethsemane that he prayed to his Father the day before, and that is, "If it be your will, let this cup pass from me." So it was nothing that Jesus was looking forward to. He dreaded it, just as you and I would, if we knew the day of our death was coming and the manner in which we would die. We just finished a whole month of celebrating the incarnation of Jesus, the time when the Son of God became the Son of Man as well. And we talked a lot about some things that have to do with that. And one of those is that we understand that Jesus had to live in order that he could die, in a sense that he lived for the purpose of dying. We also emphasize the idea that we need to understand that he died for me, specifically me. There's probably no better description of what we're talking about here in the incarnation than is given by the Apostle Paul when he writes, "Although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." You think about Peter's sermon early on in the book of Acts, where he says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death." There are many factors that are part of the plan of redemption. Certainly, the birth of Jesus is one. And we understand that if you take any one of those particular things out of the picture, then the whole thing falls apart. We know that Jesus had to be born. We also know that he had to live our life. He had to live that perfect life that would be represented for us, or given to us, the righteousness through the keeping of God's perfect law, perfectly, always, sinless in every way. He had to be that way, that we would have a Savior. We know that he had to die, and in his death he paid the penalty for the sins of those who had placed their faith and trust and hope in him. We also know that he had to be resurrected, because it was in the resurrection that he overcame the curse of death that we would follow behind him. And we know that it was essential for him to ascend back into heaven, where he sits right now. He's in the throne room of God at the right hand of God the Father, and he continues to intercede on our behalf in the heavenly places. Whenever your name comes up, Jesus steps up. Never think about that sometimes your name echoes through the halls of heaven? Can you imagine? But I want to challenge us with the idea this morning, the humiliation of Christ was just as absolutely essential to the plan of salvation as all these other things. Sometimes we look and we wonder why these people seem to be so much in the dark. I mean, these guys were Jews. You would think that they would know Jewish things. You would think that they would know lots about what the Old Testament scriptures taught. And if they knew anything, they would know particular things about Jesus. Descriptions given in different places in the Old Testament in regard to the Messiah, the long-awaited one who was coming. You would have thought, too, that they would understand that humiliation was a part of the picture. Now, we know that Peter reacted to this first time Jesus said it. He said, "No way that's going to happen to you. May it never be." But these things are taught in the scriptures. And so anyone that's familiar with the scriptures, including the Pharisees and the scribes, who were most noted for knowing the scriptures, should have understood how these things came together in the personhood of Jesus Christ. However, they seem to have been in the darkness. Couple of passages in the Old Testament that speak particularly about the humiliation and the suffering of the Messiah. Psalm 22, verses 6 through 18, and Isaiah chapter 53, the whole chapter. If you want to understand what Jesus really endured in his suffering and his humiliation, there's no better places for you to go in the whole Bible than to those particular passages. they should have also understood something, and that is that Jerusalem was a key. Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, was key to bringing all of the things that had been prophesied to come to pass. Now, why would I say that? I would say things like Genesis chapter 22. Now, what took place in Genesis chapter 22? Was that something that took place early on in the Bible? Had to do with a guy named Abraham, right? And had to do with his son named Isaac. And God told him to take that son and to go with him to the mountains of Moriah. And when you get there, you're going to sacrifice that son that you've waited so many years for. Just remember, that was where the temple was. The temple mount was built upon the mountains of Moriah. And that's where Abraham said that God would provide the sacrifice, which he did, a ram caught in the thicket. But we understand that as a foreshadowing of a much greater sacrifice ahead, the sacrifice of Jesus. Where? In Jerusalem. Jesus is now on the road to that place, the place of what many would consider to be his ultimate humiliation, where he would suffer everything almost imaginable by the hands of sinful men. If our Lord suffered as he did, if he was humiliated as he was, wouldn't you think that there might be some place for humiliation and suffering in our lives as we follow along with him? Most of us have suffered humiliation. It seems as though there are people in this world, they get their joy, they get their delight out of making other people or humiliating other people. Have you ever known anybody like that? Schoolyard bullies. I was in CVS the other day picking up a prescription, and I always talk with the people there, and this guy says to me, he's the guy behind the cash register, says, "You got to be the tallest man I've ever seen in my life." I'm going, "Well," he says, "yeah, I know you, and the reason I know you is because you're the tallest person who comes in here." I'm thinking, well, a lot of people are taller than I did have on my motorcycle boots, which have 2-inch heels on them, so. But anyway, you need to understand something, and that is I used to be a runt. Always been one of the taller kids in class and stuff like that. But when I graduated from high school, I was 6 feet tall and weighed 130 pounds. Which means I was a very favorite victim of the schoolyard bullies because there wasn't much I could do to protect myself. Some of you know what that's like, right? But it always seems as though there are people, they get this great delight out of humiliating other people. You've heard me talk about my grandmother that we called Mama, and she grew up on a farm in South Georgia and had lots of brothers and sisters. They were very poor. And so they were very often ridiculed. One day, one of her younger brothers run down by a group of bullies, and they took a pump, and they pumped him full of air. And I'm not going to go into details about how they did that. Can you think of anything else that would be more humiliating to a person than being subjected to something like that and not being able to do anything about it? And we believe that there's goodness in all people. my friends, what do you think was going through the mind of Jimbo Fisher and Jameis Winston on Thursday night when FSU was tromped by the opposition? Not just beaten, but utterly and absolutely humiliated. Do you know anybody that really relishes humiliation? Know anybody that sits out every morning and thinks, I really want to be humiliated today. I'm going to do everything I can do to be humiliated in some way. Very different than Jesus' picture. Because Jesus knew that utter and absolute humiliation was part of the big picture for him. Because he suffered humiliation, you and I will suffer humiliation at the hands of the world. Maybe not in the extreme forms that he did, but we will. You've seen it before. People have made fun of you because you really believe in Jesus, and you really go. You are a very regular attender at church, and you know you could be spending your time doing all kinds of other things, and you pray, and you know, one of those fanatical kind of people. You kind of wear your religion on your cuff. Very often, humiliation can lead to things like death. Jesus is the best example of that. But he's not the only one. How many of you guys have read Fox's Book of the Martyrs? Some of you have. A good bit of you, many of you have not. So here's another book. Every now and then I bring up a book and I say, this is one of the books I think every Christian should read. It is Fox's Book of the Martyrs. But it gives us a history of the humiliation of the church over and over and over again. And very often that humiliation came to be things like death, utter death, you know, horrible, torturous, terrible death. And we need to understand that God lets those kinds of things happen. As a matter of fact, they are part of God's predetermined plan. Because God uses those things to accomplish particular things. Do you realize that God is so big, he is so grand, he is so awesome, he is so majestic, that even our best efforts to comprehend any of that stuff fall so far short they're not even worth talking about? In other words, the distance between our understanding of the majesty of God and the real majesty of God is as far away as from here to the edge of the universe. That's 49 billion light years. As far as we can tell from here. Most of you know I have a biology background. In biology, we talk about lower life forms, and we talk about higher life forms. Lower life forms would be things like bacteria, you know, some of those little things that are responsible for us getting sick sometimes. And all. You need to understand there are a lot of bacteria out there that are friends. Only 2% of them are pathogenic, cause diseases. But they're around us. They're in us. They're all over the place all the time. But we would look at a bacterium and say, you know what, as far as I know, that's got to be about the most simplest life form there possibly could be. And we'd categorize other things as lower life forms, bacteria, plants really, because they can't move around, they can't talk, and they can't think, and they can't do this, that, and the other. And you know, all those little single-celled protozoans and phytoplankton and all that kind of stuff. What would you think if someone came to you one day and said, I'm going to make you into a bacterium? Or I'm going to make you into a tree. Would that be something that would be appealing to you? Would you jump at the opportunity for something like that to happen? Have you ever wanted to be a bacterium? Have you ever wanted to be a lower life form? Now put yourself in Jesus' shoes. We're talking about God stepping down so low that you can't even imagine how low it is. And yet he did it. What I'm saying here, it was utter and absolute humiliation for Jesus, the Son of God, to also become a man. It was humiliating to him. It was stepping down far further than we can even begin to understand what farness is. Why would he do something like that? There's only one answer. He loves you that much. See, Jesus gave up a bunch. More than we can even begin to comprehend or conceive of. God loved you enough to suffer immeasurable humiliation for you. What keeps us from humility ourselves? Well, there basically always comes down to arrogance and pride. Thinking there's more to us than there is. Thinking more highly of ourselves than we have any ground to think of. These 12 guys are going to, well, we have to take Judas out of the picture because we're not exactly sure when he went out of the picture completely. But every one of these guys witnessed the utter humiliation of Jesus on the cross. They heard the things people were saying about him. They saw people spitting upon him. They saw the bloody shred of his back. They heard the nails driven into his hands and feet. And they themselves would learn the lesson of humility, of humiliation. Every one of them would suffer a great deal in life. John was the only one who didn't give his life specifically and directly because he was Christian. Now, let me tell you, he did indirectly because he was the only one that died from apparently of old age. But in his old age, he was in bad shape. Why? Because he had endured all kinds of torture and all kinds of things on behalf of Jesus in his lifetime. You see, they understood that their own humiliation was part of the picture. That being associated with Jesus would lead to that. Peter writes, "Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you." How do we respond when crisis hits? Why is this happening to me? Or there was a really bad time. This could be some. This is the worst time this possibly could happen, right? So why are we surprised when bad things come upon us? We should not be. We should expect those things. Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree you share in the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing with exaltation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. You see, every Christian is called to partake in the suffering of Christ. Every Christian. You ever read 2 Corinthians chapter 11? Paul lists some of the trials and tribulations that he went through. Why? Because he wants to brag to people to make them think he's just a super duper Christian? No. Because he wants to, them to understand that he understands where they are. We have to realize this, even though we may not see the reason for it, that every time we suffer, it is for the good. It's always for the good. Good for us, but good beyond us. For instance, if you went back through history, you'd find that there is a lot of people who came to faith in Jesus Christ because of what they saw lived out in the life of a believer. How do you think someone would react to a picture like this, that there's something when someone has been arrested because they are Christians, or maybe they're a preacher and they're teaching about the gospel and all of that, and it's contrary to the will of the governing bodies and that sort of thing. And they're arrested and they're tried and they're found guilty and they're burned at the stake. The whole time singing praises to God. We can't even conceive of anything like that, can we? How many times do you think that there were people watching that who were just amazed at what they saw? How many people do you think over the generations have been converted to Christianity because they've seen how Christians endure things like this for the truth and the good of the gospel? You and I live in a fairy tale land. We really do. We fuss and we gripe about this, that, and the other and all that. But you and I, as far as suffering goes, most of us don't know diddly squat about suffering compared to most of the people in the world. You know, if we have aches and pains, we go to the doctor, and usually the doctor can help us. A lot of people don't have that opportunity. What they get up with in the morning, they endure that whole day. And if it goes on longer than that day, they endure it, they endure it, they endure it to the end of their life. And we gripe and we complain. When so many of our hurts and harms can be alleviated. So why? Well, there are a lot of things accomplished in it. One of the things, like we said before, is unbelievers are very often converted when they see what Christians are willing to endure and do it very gracefully and graciously. Stephen, the deacon Stephen, the first martyr, stoned to death, echoing the same words of Jesus as his death, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Can you picture yourself like that? If you can, you're probably in big trouble. Another thing that humiliation does is it teaches people humility. I mean, sometimes it's the only way that we'll learn what humility is to be humiliated first. Another thing it does is it encourages our brothers and sisters in their own suffering. So is suffering all bad, guys? No. But you and I run from it every time we have a chance. Our view of suffering, for the most part today, is the same one that you find in the culture, and that is this, is that when you suffer, you do whatever you have to do to alleviate it as soon as possible. Whether it be physical pain, whether it be this, whether it be that, that's our mentality, is we get rid of it. that you need to understand something, that it all comes upon us from God, and it has a purpose always. First thing that should come to our mind is, what purpose is being served in this? How can this be used for God's glory? How can this be used to encourage a brother and sister? How could this be used to challenge an unbeliever? Just remember this. You will never suffer anything at all that God will not bring good out of. There's a sense in which Jesus' humiliation ended at the resurrection, because he ascended back into heaven and he sits at the right hand of God the Father now, and all of that. But his church continues to experience it. And when his church does, his people do, he does. The first words that the Apostle Paul ever heard spoken from Jesus, at least on a one-to-one, we don't know how, if Paul was ever there at any, you know, sermon that Jesus preached or anything like that. He just appears in the book of Acts. But the first thing Jesus said to him was, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting my church?" Is that what he said? No. He said, "Me." Which tells you that when someone persecutes his church, they are fundamentally and essentially persecuting him. So there is a sense in which the humiliation of Jesus continues through the humiliation of the church. Just think about all the things he endured. Betrayal. Denial. Denial by those closest to him. He was falsely accused. He was falsely found guilty by a kangaroo court. He endured physical torture that is incomprehensible. Incomprehensible to us. Ever been spit on? Probably as a kid you were. There's something about people to understand that spitting is really like one of the most derogatory things you can possibly do to somebody. Little kids believe that. So because what do? They start spitting on people when they do something they don't like. Lori and I were in Uganda, and we were on our way back, and it's funny, you know, we were going there, we went through New York and then Brussels and all that, you know, and it's like you're going from a good place to not as quite as good, to lesser, and by the time you get to where we go, you're out in the boondocks in the middle of Uganda with the drums beating at night and, you know, and all that kind of stuff going on. But when, you know, you do the turnaround, you leave there, and then you get back to Fort Portal, which is, you know, a town. But, you know, no one in this room would probably think about living in a place like Fort Portal. I mean, it's run down as run down can be run down, that kind of stuff. But it was amazing how, Lori remembers, how beautiful Fort Portal appeared to us after we'd been where we were. And then every step back to what we consider to be the more civilized world, more and more and more. And by the time we got home, we appreciated what we had here far more than we ever had in our whole lifetime. And I remember a lot of things about Uganda, but one of the things I remember is when we were coming back down out of the mountains and we were coming into Fort Portal, there was an old African man walking down the side of the road. And when we passed, he spit at us. He didn't even know us. Jesus was spit on. He may have even had a bath in spit, basically. Mocked, laughed at. Dead. But then the great turnaround. Life again. A better life. We live in a time when humiliation will come upon us at times. It shouldn't surprise us. But there will come a time when that will be in the past. Never again. In the meantime, however, don't be surprised at the ordeals that come upon you. It's all a part of sharing in the suffering and humiliation of our Lord Jesus.